Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Suresh Ramalingam from Emory University in Atlanta. And to begin, I asked him about a presentation he did at the 2018 ESMO meeting on patients with EGFR tumor mutations who received first-line treatment with osimertinib as part of the clinical trial.
So in the U.S. now, the frontline therapy for an exon 19 or 21 mutated patient is more commonly osimertinib based on the strength of the FLAURA data. And the median PFS is about 19 months. Osimertinib has good brain coverage. It's also well tolerated. We're beginning to understand the resistance mechanisms to osimertinib, and the abstract that you referred to at ESMO, we had the fortune of presenting it. And what we had done was collected blood samples at baseline and at the time of either progression or drug discontinuation on both arms of the FLAURA trial. When we narrowed down on the osimertinib arm of the trial, there were 91 patients who had matched plasma. And when we looked at the resistance mechanisms in the cell-free DNA system, we found that the C797S mutation was seen in about 7% of the patients. We found MET amplifications in another 15%. So about 25% of the patients, we were able to find a clear potential mechanism of resistance. We can't definitively say this is why they progressed, but it makes a lot of theoretical sense that this is why they progressed.
And actually, now that I think about it, so many oncologists send me cases nowadays. I got another case from an oncologist who had a patient who developed a BRAF, V600E tumor mutation. So incidentally, what do you do in that situation if they develop a BRAF mutation?
I think it's very reasonable to try in an outside the clinical trial setting specific BRAF inhibitors now that those drugs are available. And we are beginning to see these are NF1s. Unfortunately, you can't put them on a clinical trial, but certainly I would be eager to try something like that if I can get the drugs provided by the company on those patients.
Do we know, and I don't know how many patients you had in that series that you reported, when you have these BRAF tumor mutations developed, do they act like the regular BRAF? Because they respond. Do these people respond? Do we know?
So I have one patient who developed a RAF1 mutation on osimertinib, and I treated the patient with sorafenib, and he's about almost 10 months into the treatment, did well. He had a good response and then remained stable. And more recently, about 2 months ago, he progressed. So I moved to chemotherapy. This was a RAF1 mutation. This is not the V600E BRAF mutation.
Wow. Oh, that's interesting.
So we had to treat him with sorafenib as a single agent.
That's interesting. What about, do you see the regular V600E mutations?
I have not personally seen one, but in the FLAURA study, we did see there was one case. I don't have follow-up to know what exactly that patient was treated at this point.
And the other thing about that case that we were talking about was, do you keep the TKI going? And this doc asked the same question. Until you bring in your other therapy, do you keep it going indefinitely, temporarily? What do you think?
In a specific BRAF situation where you have to give them two drugs to treat, one has to think about whether it'll be safe to add three TKIs. So I would stop osimertinib and go to the next set of treatment strategies, which is a similar approach I would take with the patient situation you started off with from your physician, which is they are moving away from osimertinib into second-line therapy, and they're thinking about chemotherapy. For that patient, I would stop osimertinib and move to chemotherapy.
And the doc also mentioned this C797S mutation. Is that druggable?
Yes, it is druggable. We don't have a lot of clinical data, but preclinically, you can actually give gefitinib or erlotinib and get a response in those patients when they progress on osimertinib and have the C797S.
So he also refers to this issue. These people with a tumor mutation, like EGFR, for example, there was a time when people said delay giving PD-1 inhibitors until they've had chemo, maybe a couple lines of chemo. Now we're hearing people talk about maybe chemo plus checkpoint, maybe plus Bev from the Empower study, and he refers to that too. What about that strategy in people progressing on osimertinib?
I'm very intrigued by the data from the Empower 150 study. It was not a planned analysis. It was a post hoc analysis. They had about 65 patients with EGFR mutation. There seemed to be, when they got chemo plus Bev plus atezo compared to chemo plus Bev, there was a favorable hazard ratio for the EGFR mutated patients. Now, I would also say that the other Empower study that was just reported recently, when they just gave chemo plus atezo, there was absolutely no benefit in the EGFR mutated patients. So if you are going in that direction, you want to give a PD-1 inhibitor, by default, it would have to be chemo plus Bev plus atezolizumab. My own view is, I think this is an interesting observation that needs some prospective studies, even a randomized phase 2, would help us sort out exactly how best to use PD-1 plus chemo combination.
You know, it's interesting. You think about Bev, you know, anti-angiogenics with checkpoint inhibitors been talked about a lot, some TKIs, renal, et cetera. But, you know, in terms of this particular situation, it kind of reminded me of, there was a study back that looked at erlotinib plus Bev that, I mean, then the checkpoint inhibitors came along, everybody sort of forgot about it. But so there was this kind of interest in Bev and people with EGFR tumor mutation. What do you think that was all about?
So we saw a lot of that discussion at ASCO in 2018, where there were two studies. One was a follow-up on a Japanese study that had been reported almost 4 or 5 years ago, where combining erlotinib plus Bev had a PFS of almost 16 and a half months. Now, what they found after extended follow-up is there was no survival difference with erlotinib versus erlotinib alone. A second trial reported also showed a very similar PFS, median PFS duration. They don't have the survival follow-up. So there are like a couple of studies now that show that the combination has at least ability to prolong PFS. In the US, there is a trial led by Dr. Tom Stinchcomb from the Alliance that was also looking at the same question, erlotinib. This would be the first study in the Western population, and I'm eager to wait for the results of that. There's also ongoing plan to study osimertinib and bevacizumab. So I think there is something to the combination. How best to use that, we have to learn, whether there is a biomarker even within the EGFR group that'll tell us which patient should get the combination versus just a monotherapy would also be an interesting question to ask.
Wow, that's interesting. Osimertinib and Bev. Wow, there's a study looking at that?
There is an ongoing study, phase 1/2 done at Memorial and ECOG. We're planning a randomized phase 3 trial.
Wow. My question is why? Why would EGFR TKI and Bev be synergistic?
We know very little about the synergy. In the initial days, the combination was studied primarily in the EGFR wild-type setting when erlotinib and bevacizumab was evaluated in a large phase 3 trial. And the idea is angiogenesis is playing an important role in disease progression in an EGFR mutated tumor, just like it does in other settings. Perhaps the synergy is far more evident in the EGFR tumors compared to the wild-type tumors.
That's interesting. The other thing that you reported, and I think I'd heard about it before, was MET. Was it mutations or amplification?
Amplifications.
So what does that mean? Do you use MET inhibitors? What's that all about?
So there is some information on adding osimertinib with a MET inhibitor in this situation. And what we're beginning to see is responses in 30 to 50% of the patients when you have MET amplification and you give them this combination.
This is a TKI?
This is a TKI that's directed against MET. It's called savolitinib. And the TATEN trial is the one where we were studying all these combinations, osimertinib plus a MEK inhibitor, osimertinib plus a MET inhibitor. And we also studied osimertinib plus Durva, but that had to stop for toxicity reasons. In the World Conference in Yokohama, we reported the cohort with osimertinib and savolitinib. And that's where we saw that there was a good response rate, about 35% in patients who progressed on a TKI, had MET amplification, non-T790, when you give them osimertinib plus a MET inhibitor. So I think we're going to see when first-line osimertinib is used, MET amplification is going to be a common resistance mechanism. When we look at plasma, plasma is not good for reporting amplifications. So tissue biopsy is probably going to be needed. In the flora plasma data, we reported MET amplification was seen in 15%. We unfortunately did not have tumor tissues at the time of progression on the flora study. But as we do biopsies, I think that number is going to go up. And we will be looking at the combination of TKI plus a MET inhibitor for these patients.
But I mean, 15% is significant. Now, I kind of remember, that wasn't there a monoclonal antibody against MET?
A long time ago, MetMab was the antibody that was being developed with erlotinib. That was studied in a wild-type patient population. We do have a good plethora of MET inhibitors now still in development. So I think once we carve out this patient population based on biopsy or plasma, there's going to be a resurgence of interest in studying MET inhibition in this group.
Can you just sort of also explain what the difference between MET amplification is and like MET exon 14 mutations, for example?
Sure. So MET exon 14 mutation is seen in about 3-4% of non-small cell lung cancers. If you have a patient with sarcomatoid histology, you're probably going to see it in a greater proportion of patients. That is a de novo mutation that you see in these patients, and there are MET inhibitors that are being studied. Crizotinib has some data on this patient population showing responses in about 40% of the patients, and a number of other MET inhibitors are being studied. So checking for the MET 14 exon skip mutation is now done by all these NGS panels. Unless you're only looking for EGFR, ALK, and ROS1, you should be able to pick this up. And at least now there are some options for these patients in a clinical trial or a therapeutic experiment kind of setting. MET amplification is basically the cell making more copies of the MET gene to drive the pathway signaling. And that we see in the context primarily of acquired resistance to EGFR inhibition. Now, it could possibly happen with other targeted agents as well in the setting of acquired resistance. Basically, what we know is the RAF-RAS MAP kinase pathway is turned on as acquired resistance develops to EGFR TKIs. And MET amplification is probably responsible for anywhere in the order of 20 to 30% of the patients who develop acquired resistance to EGFR TKI. We've seen that with erlotinib. Now we're seeing that with osimertinib.
So I can't remember what kind of abnormality I've heard this talked about, but the issue of bringing in a second generation drug like erlotinib, gefitinib, after osimertinib. What's that about?
So that would be a situation where somebody develops a C797S mutation. And what happens is the C797 is the site where osimertinib binds to the receptor. So when you have a secondary mutation there, osimertinib is no longer able to bind to the receptor and produce the interruption in signaling. Whereas EGFR first generation TKIs bind at a different site. So you could, for those patients who develop C797S, give them a therapeutic trial of gefitinib or erlotinib. Now, do you have to give both osimertinib and gefitinib? We don't know those answers, but certainly trying a course of gefitinib or erlotinib would be a reasonable thing to do for these patients.
I was just flashing on the fact that, I don't know if you know this, but in 2004, I was scheduled to interview somebody I never heard of named Tom Lynch. I asked them about, well, why do you see these people with each of, you know, who responded drugs like gefitinib so well? And like, he got all red in the face and he said, well, we can't talk about it right now. And I'm like, what? And like the next day was the New England Journal paper, which had been embargoed that he couldn't talk about, describing the EGFR tumor mutation. And here we are, we just spent 20 minutes talking about resistance to a third generation agent. So, wow.
Fascinating how that field has emerged. You're referring to May 2004 when the two papers came out back to back?
That's exactly when it was, 2004. And then I had to go back and interview him at ASCO to get the real story of the whole thing, you know. But anyhow, from a practical point of view, do you think that outside a trial setting, doc and community-based practice, first of all, do you think they should do plasma biopsies or assays before therapy? And do you think they should do them on progression of osimertinib and maybe even act on them outside a trial?
For a patient who is newly diagnosed with non-squamous or adeno specifically, I still like to have a tissue-based diagnosis to start with. Now, there are some situations where there's insufficient tissue and a second biopsy is not deemed safe for the patient, or if the patient just has bone-only disease, then it's reasonable to get a plasma cell-free DNA to test for it. And these assays that are available commercially have a good sensitivity. They are able to pick almost 80% of what you would pick up on the tissue, but one has to be aware there is still a possibility about 20 to 30% of the patients where you don't see any cell-free DNA. In the FLORA data, 19% of the patients with tissue-positive EGFR mutations were non-shedders. In other words, they have nothing on plasma, but they have the mutation in the tissue. So one has to keep that in mind, that there is a caveat to the results from the plasma testing.
That's really interesting. I hadn't heard that before. Let me just ask you, do you think, I've heard people say that there are that there are potential advantages to liquid biopsies, that maybe you pick up things that you actually don't get on tissue, that ideally you do both. What do you think about that thought?
There are certain instances, because when we do biopsies of the tumor, you're going in blindly and you may hit the region of a tumor where the cells are not rich in mutations. So there are situations where the tissue might miss it and the plasma might catch it. And certainly, if you had a tissue diagnosis with NGS and you see nothing there or something that doesn't make sense, you could correlate with plasma side by side to see if you can put those together and make sense out of the data. There's a lot of interest in using plasma to understand early progression, early development of resistance, whereby studying it serially, even when a patient is on therapy, could be a potential approach. I would say that's still being sorted out in a research setting. What we have seen is that if you are a shedder, which means you're a patient with EGFR mutation, your plasma is positive at baseline, and you start those patients on a TKI, within 6 weeks, you can check the plasma again, and if they clear completely, those patients do a lot better compared to who we refer to as persisters, where the plasma still shows the EGFR mutation. So I think down the road where we will be going with this is, you start somebody on a TKI in 6 weeks, you kind of get a sense which way things are going, and you quickly adapt therapy. Maybe you want to bring in chemo, or you bring in another drug on top of your TKI for those not so good responders.
You bring in Bev.
Bringing Bev could be clearly an option.
I remember hearing about people talking about that as a strategy, that when you progress, you know, before checkpoint and all that, you know, when you progress on each of our TKI, to add Bev.
Right.
Where are we today with data from the FLAURA trial? What have we seen in terms of survival benefit? And what are some of the trials utilizing osimertinib in other settings, particularly earlier stage disease, that we might be seeing in the next couple of years?
Sure. The FLAURA study, the paper was published in the New England Journal. And at that time, we had results for the mature PFS data. We had duration of response, which was twofold higher for patients treated with osimertinib. We had the safety profile. The PFS hazard ratio, as you recall, Neil, was about 0.46. And the median PFS was 19 months with osimertinib compared to 10.2 months in the erlotinib or gefitinib group. At the time of that analysis, the survival data maturity was at about 20%. And the hazard ratio for survival, even with the low maturity, was 0.63, and the p-value was 0.0067. Now, we could not technically call it as statistically significant, because for that level of maturity, for the 20% maturity, our p-value should have been at least 0.0015 or lesser. So at this time, we call it a promising trend. And the survival data continues to mature. And our anticipation is that sometime in 2019, we will have the mature survival results from the FLAURA study to report. In the meanwhile, clearly, there is a lot of interest in developing osimertinib-based combinations, studying osimertinib in earlier stages of the disease. So in the adjuvant therapy setting, there is a trial called ADORA, which enrolls patients with stage 1B, 2, and 3 lung cancer after they've had surgical resection, and after those who need adjuvant chemotherapy are given adjuvant chemotherapy, then they are randomized to osimertinib or not. And that's the ongoing trial. That's a global trial. Now, more recently, we're launching a trial in stage 3B locally advanced patients. These are patients who are not candidates for surgery. They get chemo radiation. And if they have an EGFR mutation, after chemo RT, they're randomized to osimertinib or observation. So that's the study called the LAURA study that's just kicking off right now. And that'll also be a global study.
So what about durvalumab?
So for that particular study for EGFR mutated patients, they will not get durvalumab. It'll be just osimertinib or observation. Since we think that the EGFR mutation question is still a relevant one to see whether osimertinib might fit in better than a PD-1 inhibitor. Now, the PACIFIC trial did show a favorable hazard ratio for the EGFR mutated patients. So in the US, my feeling is a lot of physicians would like to give patients durvalumab, but certainly in the global setting, the LAURA trial still remains very relevant.
What happened to that other trial? I thought it was a really cool trial. I think it somehow ended where they were going to give, the idea was to give targeted therapy, I think it was EGFR and ALK, before chemo radiation.
Oh, okay. So that was the RTOG trial that you're referring to. And the idea was you take stage 3B patients or unresectable 3As, and if they have EGFR, you give them 3 months of TKI. They have ALK, you give them 3 months of crizotinib. And then you get to radiation part. interesting study. Unfortunately, accrual was very poor. And because of that, the study was shut down early. So we're not going to learn much from the very limited number of patients that were enrolled to that trial.
I always thought it was kind of a good idea. And I'm kind of curious, do you ever do that outside a trial setting? It makes so much sense. Just give somebody osimertinib, shrink it down before you give them chemo radiation.
Yeah. Yes, it's a shame that that trial could not accrue patients.
Do you do that yourself outside a trial?
I have not done that. I think there are many questions that come up when you start with targeted therapy and you shrink the tumor. What do you radiate? Do you radiate the original field or do you radiate the remaining field where the tumor is just present? So it opens up some doors and questions we don't have answers to. So I don't do it outside of a clinical trial.
So I'm guessing we're not going to have an adjuvant answer for a while.
Adjuvant answer, the other adjuvant trial in the space is the NCI-led Alchemist trial, where EGFR and ALK patients get specific targeted therapy versus observation. Those trials are proceeding well. The EGFR trial is more than halfway done. We anticipate it'll still be 3-4 years before we have answers from there.
So the age-old question, you have a very educated patient, maybe an oncologist, who says to you, look, I know we're waiting 3 or 4 years for these trials, but it really makes a lot of sense to me. Will you give me osimertinib? I'll get it paid for.
I have had one or two patients want to go on that, and this was before osimertinib was approved. So erlotinib was the go-to drug at that point. And we've had some patients who wanted it. At that time, we had phase 2 studies that reported favorable outcomes for patients who get 2 years of erlotinib post-surgery and chemotherapy. So outside the trial, I have done that. That's the reality of it.
I would imagine that it's going to be a lot easier to get a patient through a couple years of osimertinib than erlotinib in the adjuvant setting.
That is true, because on the adjuvant trial, SELECT trial that has been published now, a good percentage of patients only were able to get about a year of therapy. With osimertinib, the likelihood of completing 2 years of therapy is substantially higher. The other unknown question is, once you start, do you really stop in 2 years or do you give EGFR TKIs in perpetuity? Because most of the relapses in the SELECT trial happened after the 2 year point when patients came off the study. So there are many who believe that you just have to continue to give the drug for a very long time.
I don't know if you know that the original adjuvant tamoxifen trials in breast cancer, they use it for a year. Then they compared it to 2 years, then 2 to 5, et cetera. But can you imagine a year of tamoxifen?
Yep.
Anyhow, why don't we make a little rounds on some of your patients?
Okay.
These are actual people you took care of?
Yes, these are actual patients in our practice.
We just talked about EGFR, so maybe just kind of summarize what happened with this 62-year-old man. Was he a non-smoker?
He was a never smoker, and he was fully functional until a few months of shortness of breath developed. He was having cough, and he showed up in the emergency room, had a decent-sized right lower lobe lung mass with mediastinal adenopathy. And we thought he originally had locally advanced disease, but when we completed the staging workup, MRI of the brain surprisingly showed about 20-odd lesions in the brain. They were all relatively small, less than a centimeter in size. There was one lesion, however, that was about 2.5 centimeters in size, and it was surprising he was not symptomatic from that. Biopsy of the lung lesion was consistent with adenocarcinoma. He had the exon 19 mutation, and we wanted to treat his 2.5 centimeter lesion with stereotactic radiosurgery, which is what happened, and then we started him on osimertinib. He had a good response. The brain actually showed good response as well with osimertinib. He started feeling better within about 3 or 4 weeks. First scan after about 2.5 months into therapy showed a good response, would fit in the category of partial response. So he's about 6 months into treatment now. His brain looks very stable to much better, and his systemic disease is also much better.
What about tolerability? Any dermatologic problems, GI problems, any side effects?
With osimertinib, we see very little GI skin effects. Most of the time, even if you see it, it's grade 1 in severity. I've not seen a single case of grade 3 skin toxicity with osimertinib or even grade 3 GI toxicity. So it's a drug that's tolerated well that patients can take it for the long haul.
So this man had no problems with it at all, or is having no problems?
He had occasional loose stools that if you ask him, he would tell you. But overall, from his day-to-day activity level and lifestyle, it hasn't impacted him.
So, you know, we're always asking people what they do, and we love to ask like 25 investigators at a time what they do. You know, that's our way of kind of doing consensus. But Just kind of curious, if I were to present that case to 25 pulmonary investigators, you think all of them would have used stereotactic radiation on the 2-centimeter lesion?
For a 2-centimeter lesion, I think majority would prefer to do radiation. If all you saw was sub-centimeter lesions without edema and any other ominous features or symptoms, I think we would be very comfortable giving EGFR TKI.
Is there kind of a bar of 1 centimeter? Is that what you're saying?
Typically, our radiation oncologists like to use the 1 centimeter as an arbitrary cutoff. If it's more than a centimeter, people get a little uncomfortable of not giving radiation therapy.
Interesting. And is there a lot of data to support that size correlation at this point?
I don't think we have that kind of information. All we know is these drugs are active in the brain, and it really boils down to the local philosophy of the treating institution that we decide what's our comfort level.
Typically, do you see generally partial responses in the brain to osimertinib or TKIs, or do you see CR sometimes?
I've seen CR. Partial response is very common. We have looked at patients with brain mets across the osimertinib development program, both in the second line setting and the first line setting. And what you see is a response rate of about 50 to 80%. And CR is seen in about 10, 20% of the patients. So CR is possible.
So I was just looking at, I see here that you have a paper in the JCO on CNS response to osimertinib versus standard epidermal growth factor TKIs in untreated disease. Can you talk about that study?
Sure. This is from the FLORA study. We looked at the CNS data from patients who participated. And as you will recall, of the 556 patients enrolled in the FLORA study, approximately 20% of the patients had baseline brain mets before they were randomized in the clinical trial. And this paper you're referring to is digging into deeper details of those patients. The top level results, what I would say is, we saw partial responses in patients in the brain who received osimertinib, which was much more with osimertinib than it was with erlotinib or gefitinib. We also noticed that when patients were on osimertinib, the risk of progression in the brain was almost 2.5-fold lower compared to getting erlotinib or gefitinib. So even in patients without obvious brain mets at baseline, there is a protective effect in the brain that's better with osimertinib compared to erlotinib and gefitinib.
What about leptomeningeal disease? I assume you didn't have anybody with that in FLORA, but where are we? I know there was a paper before the Bloom study or something that reported responses. Have you had patients respond to leptomeningeal disease? How much data is there in the literature about it?
Sure. So we have now two lines of evidence. The Bloom study that you mentioned was a trial done in Asia where patients were treated with 160 milligrams of osimertinib. They had about 11 or 12 patients, and they saw good responses suggesting that it is effective. And more recently at the ESMO Asia meeting, the Korean group presented the patients with leptomeningeal disease treated across the osimertinib development program. And there were about 23 patients with leptomeningeal disease. And these patients were all treated with 80 milligrams of osimertinib. And they saw responses in nearly 50% of the patients. And what was very striking to me was the median PFS for those patients was close to 18 months. And that's unheard of in a group of patients with leptomeningeal disease. So even though it's a small group of patients, what it's telling is that even at the dose of 80 milligrams, the drug gets into the brain and the drug is able to exert sustained effects that helps patients.
It really is amazing. And, you know, kind of, I think people in general are pretty pessimistic about leptomeningeal disease and a lot of different cancers. But I guess theoretically, the cells have the tumor mutation. If you get the drug in there, I guess it works.
Yes.
So just kind of curious, with this man who's doing so well now in partial response, what's your follow-up on him? How often are you doing imaging, and are you doing serial? I'm assuming you're not, but are you doing serial plasma assays?
We're not doing serial plasma assays. My follow-up is after I've seen the patient through the first 3 to 4 months of therapy, where we see them a little more frequently. Every 3 months with an imaging study is pretty much what we do for our patients. Now, if somebody had some specific toxicity issue that we're working with, we'll bring them more frequently than that.
So let's talk a little bit about ALK disease. I'm really curious. I was fascinated by that presentation that was at the World Lung Meeting on brigatinib first line. I kind of wasn't expecting that. But anyhow, well, let me start out with your 44-year-old man. And we can get into where things are heading, but what happened with him? I guess he presented a couple years ago.
Yeah, so he is a 44-year-old man, again, never smoker, who presented with not feeling well, some headaches, and he had brain mets on an MRI and also had lung disease, pleural disease. So he had initially been seen at an outside facility. They saw the brain lesions. They gave him stereotactic radiosurgery for the two or three lesions that he had. And then he came in to see us at that time. His molecular testing came back positive for ALK. And we were enrolling patients at that time for a trial, phase one trial of crizotinib plus a PD-1 inhibitor. So he went on that trial and did really well. And he was on the study for almost 15 months and then started developing progression in the brain and systemically. So initially he had a period of slow progression. We continued with the therapy, but when it became obvious that we had to switch, we started him on alectinib. And he has been on alectinib now for almost 8 months. He has, again, had an excellent response in the brain. He's tolerating treatment very well. He doesn't think he's on any medication to the point when you ask him. And he's able to continue in his work and is doing really well.
So I guess he's a first-generation ALK-type patient. Like, you know, in EGFR, you have these people who are still in the T790 cycle. You have people who started out on crizotinib, although he got it with a PD-1 inhibitor. How did he do when he got that? Any crizotinib toxicity? Anything from the PD-1 inhibitor?
We saw a little bit of liver transaminitis early on in the course of treatment. It sort of plateaued around a grade 1 level, so we didn't have to do anything about dose adjustment or modifications to treatment. But you're right. 2 years ago, at that time, we were using crizotinib as frontline therapy, but clearly now the field has shifted. We're using more of the next generation, more potent ALK inhibitors. Alectinib has been around. Brigatinib is likely to join ranks soon with an FDA approval. So the field has changed now dramatically in 2 years.
So again, just to backtrack, though, I'm kind of curious, when he was on the crizotinib, did he have the visual changes? Those things always fascinating. What did he describe to you?
So the nighttime when they get up to go to the restroom, he has difficulty in the dark to light adaptation. And then sometimes he would describe the flashing lights going in the evening hours when he's walking on the road or driving by. Usually the first 3-4 months after that, either it goes away or patients sort of get used to that. They don't talk about it anymore. So that's the toxicity that we see. Peripheral edema is another toxicity we see with crizotinib because of its MET effect.
So it's interesting that he was on this trial with a PD-1 inhibitor. That's a single-arm trial. Where is that strategy in general? And in fact, where is the strategy in general of using targeted therapy, not just ALK targeted therapy, other targeted therapy, combined with the PD-1 inhibitor?
It has been very slow to develop, Neil, both in the EGFR and the ALK setting. In the EGFR setting, in the TATTON trial, we had given osimertinib plus durvalumab for a cohort of patients. And we saw a lot of pneumonitis that was far more than what you would have expected with either drug alone. So we stopped the trial, and until we have a better understanding of why this happens, it's unlikely that that's going to move forward. In the ALK space, Dr. Alisha reported data with lorlatinib at ASCO with a PD-1 inhibitor, the avelumab drug, and a PD-L1 inhibitor. And she showed safety with that combination. What I would say is, even though we're seeing data with Pembro plus ALK and avelumab with crizotinib and so forth, the field has moved very slowly, which tells me that there are considerable toxicity issues, that it's not something that folks are ready to jump into.
So you mentioned the fact that alectinib, since this patient was initially diagnosed, got displaced crizotinib as first-line therapy. And now, as I was mentioning, there's a trial that was just reported with brigatinib. Can you talk about what they saw in that trial and how it compared indirectly to the trial with alectinib or the trials?
Sure. So the brigatinib versus crizotinib study that's now published in the New England Journal showed that the median PFS hazard ratio for brigatinib was 0.49. If you compare that to the ALEX trial, which was alectinib versus crizotinib, the median PFS there was 0.47. So these two drugs seem to have, even though we don't want to do trial-to-trial comparisons, they seem to be in the same ballpark. With brigatinib, what we had seen in the initial single-arm second-line studies was brain activity was quite impressive against brain metastases. We had seen that in the second-line setting, a patient with brain mets had a median PFS of 13-14 months when they got brigatinib. And the question then is brigatinib going to be better for patients with brain mets compared to alectinib? We don't know the answer for that. The hazard ratio looked really good in the brigatinib versus crizotinib study for patients who came in with brain metastases. So I think we have two good options in the frontline setting for patients with ALK translocation. Alectinib is already firmed up in that space, median PFS of about 35 months, which is remarkable.
That's amazing.
And brigatinib will probably get FDA approval soon, and we'll have two options.
What about the pulmonary reaction that's been observed with brigatinib? Was it seen in that trial? Have you seen it? What's it all about?
When we were doing clinical trials with brigatinib, I had one patient who developed a pulmonary toxicity. And this is what happened, and this is very typical from what I understand. The patient was started on day one on the clinical trial. 2 days later, he's in the emergency room with severe pulmonary toxicity. And we had to stop the drug, give him steroids. A few days later, he had improved substantially and was discharged home, and he did well. We did not re-challenge him with brigatinib. But the course of these events is that most of the events happen in the first week. So what is recommended is you give patients 90 milligrams per day of brigatinib for the first 7 days. And if they go through that well, then you go to the approved dose of 180 milligrams per day. And then you don't see that late in the course of treatment. It's the first few days. And it looks like interstitial pneumonitis on the radiographic images.
Really? Because, I mean, I was trying to figure out by asking people what it actually was, and it sounded more like some kind of reaction as opposed to a pneumonitis. But now you're saying there's radiologic. So is it an acute pneumonitis?
Clinically, it behaves like a pneumonitis, at least in my experience. The good news is the overall incidence of this toxicity is only in the order of 2 to 3%. So it's not a frequent phenomenon, but I think physicians should be aware of this so they can act early on.
Do you think it could be some kind of immune reaction?
Possible. We just don't know what exactly the body is responding to.
I guess the other thing I've been hearing about brigatinib is when you do this dosing thing and therefore hopefully avoid this problem, I guess it does avoid it, that it's extremely well tolerated. Is that your take? Can you tell the difference? Is maybe different in terms of alectinib versus brigatinib?
So both are very good tolerated drugs. With brigatinib, you occasionally see hypertension. About 10-12% of the patients may need some form of an antihypertensive to manage it. Barring that, I think these are very well-tolerated drugs.
So what about patients that progress on particularly alectinib or brigatinib? First of all, what do we know about people progressing on alectinib? Do we know whether or not people respond to either brigatinib or ceritinib, which I think is also approved?
Yeah, ceritinib is also approved in frontline.
But in people progressing on alectinib?
So it's now boiled down to understanding what's the mechanism of resistance, because you have so many gatekeeper mutations that happen with these drugs. The most worrisome gatekeeper mutation is the G12O2 mutation. And when you see a G12O2 mutation, the best option for those patients may be lorlatinib. There is some suggestion brigatinib may be active, but lorlatinib is now FDA approved. So that's what I would go to. Certainly there are anecdotal cases where patients progress on alectinib and they responded to ceritinib or brigatinib. We just don't have a lot of information. So my practice now with the approval of lorlatinib, it clearly gives me a way to get this drug in. And when patients progress on lorlatinib, then we can worry about whether we go to chemo or is there a chance that they could respond to brigatinib or ceritinib.
Yeah, I guess I was in the mode of hearing people say, we don't really know what to do. Maybe sometimes we try brigatinib. But I guess once lorlatinib was approved, like you said, that became academic.
Yes.
What do we know about lorlatinib in terms of tolerability, in terms of how it works, and whether it's being used and looked at earlier on?
Lorlatinib specifically was developed to get high levels of the drug into the brain. And we know that the response rates are in the 40 to 50% range in patients who progressed on prior ALK inhibitors. It's also active in ROS1 patients who have progressed on a ROS1 inhibition. Right now, the approval is specific for the ALK setting. The drug is given on a daily basis, relatively well tolerated, I would say. Occasionally, you see some CNS type of side effects, maybe hallucinations or behavior alterations in a small percentage of patients. But those are usually in the first few days of therapy with continued treatment. That's not an issue.
So is lorlatinib being looked at in the upfront setting?
I believe there is a trial comparing lorlatinib to crizotinib in the frontline setting that's ongoing. I don't know what the status of that specific trial is, but that is very much how they are moving forward to developing the drug.
We were talking before about BRAF mutations. What happened with your 52-year-old lady?
Well, this was one of the most dramatic situations that I have witnessed in targeted therapies. We used to see these in the EGFR world in the 2004-2005 timeframe that you earlier talked about. This lady is fully functional, fully active individual who came in with a few months of progressive dyspnea, and she had extensive bilateral pulmonary disease, lymphangitic carcinomatosis, and tumor in the right lung. And she was originally diagnosed with lung adenocarcinoma. At that time, BRAF was not something that routinely was done as part of the initial panel. So she had been tested for EGFR, negative for EGFR, ALK, and ROS1. So we had started her on chemotherapy, and then we were waiting for NGS testing to come back. With the platinum doublet, I would say her response was maybe at best stable disease for a very short duration. But we got the NGS results back. She had the BRAF V600E mutation. At that time, the combination was not approved. So we had to get special access for her, and the company was kind enough to let her get those two drugs. And her response was very dramatic. Within the first 2 months, she went off oxygen. Her pleural effusion stopped recurring. She was back to feeling her original self. And we were very excited about it. And when David Planchard reported the results, the median PFS in his frontline combination study was about 10 and a half months. So as she got to the one-year point, we started getting nervous that maybe she's going to progress. But she was doing fine. And 2 years into therapy, she had no signs of progression. She's now 2.5 years into it, tolerating extremely well. In the last few months, I do see some minor pulmonary nodules showing up in the 2 to 3 millimeter range here and there. I am still keeping her on the combination regimen. But this, to me, illustrates the power of the combination therapy for a patient with BRAF V600E mutation.
Kind of curious, was she a smoker?
She was not a smoker. She's not a smoker.
Am I correct in saying that a fair number of people with BRAF tumor mutations are smokers?
Yes, that is correct. Unlike what we see in EGFR and ALK, with BRAF, we do see it in smokers more commonly.
So in terms of Monday morning quarterbacking, I'm kind of curious. If you had a patient, if she presented today and you knew she had a BRAF mutation, as sick as she was, would you still go on with chemotherapy?
No. For BRAF, I would definitely go with frontline targeted therapy because the response rates are pretty good, 65%, which is not what we see with chemo. So my first line is for a BRAF mutated patient, the combination of Dabrafenib and Trametinib.
And you don't think you lose anything in terms of speed or response?
No, I don't think so.
Right now, before we get off targeted therapy, what are the genomic alterations where you use targeted therapy first line in addition to ALK, EGFR, now you just said BRAF? We talked before about MET-exon 14. You use targeted upfront there?
So no, for MET-exon 14, I would use targeted therapy in more the second line or later setting. But we used to say four, now there are five alterations where we would use frontline targeted therapy, EGFR, ALK, ROS1, BRAF, and the most recent entrance is the NTRK fusion.
Oh, I thought you were going to say RET.
RET, we don't have an approved drug yet. For NTRK, we have an approved drug.
Well, that's true.
Once we have an approved drug for RET, that'll be six, and I'm hoping that happens very soon because there is a very promising RET inhibitor that's been published on.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's going to fall into the same category.
Absolutely. It has a 75% response rate and a median PFS that hadn't been reached at the time of the report. So certainly that drug is something I'm hoping will get into the clinic very soon.
Yeah, we did a survey, you probably were in it a couple of years ago, of investigators. And one of the questions we asked is first line. And at that point, RET and HER2 for sure were not first line. Now RET, I think, is going to come into the first line. I don't know what's left, but I guess HER2 is still nothing, huh?
HER2, I think we are seeing still the 30-40% response rates, which are not enough to move HER2-targeted drugs to the frontline space.
One of the big things that's happened in the last couple of years in terms of immunotherapy has been the use of people with locally advanced disease getting chemo radiation therapy in the Pacific trial. So I want to kind of see where you are today with that. Maybe we can get into that by hearing about your 58-year-old man.
Yeah, so this was about a year ago, right on the aftermath of Pacific trial reading out, where I had seen him. He was in very good health, had presented with some totally unrelated chest pain to the emergency room, And incidentally, they found out that he had this left lung nodule, which is about 2 centimeters in size. But that was not the entire story, because he also had on the PET scan FDG avid node in the left side of the mediastinum and in the left supraclavicular area. And these were biopsy-proven sites of squamous cell carcinoma. So he ended up with locally advanced multistation N2 disease with a supraclav nodal involvement. So we proceeded with chemoradiation therapy to him. He tolerated well. And within 3 or 4 weeks of completing chemoradiation, we had started him on durvalumab. And now he's coming up for completion of a year next month. He's done extremely well, and his scan showed very good response. Out of curiosity, we ended up getting a PET scan last month, and it's completely negative. He has no FDG uptake anywhere in the primary tumor or the lymph nodes. And it's very exciting, and we're keeping our fingers crossed as to his long-term outcomes. But to me, that experience was very positive.
Just kind of curious, when you evaluated him initially, what would you have estimated his chance of dying of the disease with just chemoradiation therapy? I'm thinking a lot more and more about numeracy in oncology, the numbers that you give to patients who want them. So I'm kind of curious if this man, maybe he asked you initially what his baseline risk would be with just chemoradiation, how that would change from an absolute level in your best estimation with a durvalumab, and also what your estimation is now currently with this great response of him developing recurrent disease.
Sure. So we've been used to the numbers with chemo RT being somewhere in the order of 15 to 20% 5-year survival for stage 3 unresectable disease patients. Until durvalumab, nothing had shown beyond chemo radiation to improve the outcomes. Now we know that with the PACIFIC trial giving 1 year of durva, it results in a hazard ratio for overall survival of 0.68. And in the PACIFIC trial, the median had not been reached. But if you look at the 18-month survival rate, there's almost a 12-point difference favoring, in absolute terms, the use of durvalumab. So what I think with extended follow-up we're going to see is there'll be a bigger tail, a number of patients that will have long-term survival. And my hope is that we push that 5-year survival by 5 to 10 points at least with durvalumab. Now, I'm just hoping for that. More would be better. We won't know that for at least another couple of years, is my feeling, as follow-up continues on the trial. So what I tell the patient is his survival possibility is going to be improved by almost 1/3 with the use of durvalumab based on the hazard ratio alone.
Where do we stand today, both in terms of clinical research data and also your clinical observations in practice in terms of toxicity tolerability issues by adding in durvalumab? This man sounds like he completely sailed through it. Again, I don't know when he first talked to you about it. What number would you give to a patient if they said, what's the chance I'm going to just go through this like this man did with zero problems?
Right. So we know that chemoradiation therapy has pulmonary toxicity as one of the adverse events, and that can happen up to a year, both acute pulmonary toxicity and delayed pulmonary toxicity. What was reassuring from the PACIFIC trial was we did see pulmonary toxicity, but the difference between the control arm and the durva arm was relatively modest. There wasn't a substantial increase in pulmonary toxicity with durva in the post-chemo RT setting. So I would say there's probably about a 5% higher likelihood of developing pneumonitis because of the fact that somebody receives durvalumab. And most of them tend to be grade 1 or 2 in severity, where you can manage them with steroids and supportive care and get them through that phase. So I would say it is a risk that patients and physicians should be aware of, but the benefits clearly outweigh those risks.
You know, in the metastatic setting, it sounds like there are situations where people are not really sure, oncologists are not really sure whether or not they're dealing with pulmonary toxicity from a checkpoint inhibitor, disease progression, cardiorespiratory disease from smoking-related problems or age, et cetera. What about in the locally advanced setting? Are there any issues in differentiating, for example, radiation pneumonitis from durvalumab pneumonitis?
I don't think we can clearly use either radiographic or clinical criteria to distinguish one from the other. They both have similar time frames in the post-chemo RT setting. I think it's just one question where you start treating them with steroids, and if the pneumonitis is not severe enough, then you can re-challenge them with durvalumab. If you have a grade 3 pneumonitis, I would just stop. It doesn't matter whether they got it from durva or from the fact that they got RT prior to starting durva.
How do you monitor patients during that year of durvalumab? And do you look, for example, at thyroid function preemptively?
We've gotten used to checking thyroid function on patients getting PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors from the metastatic setting. So I do the same thing with durva during that year of therapy. Besides that, I don't specifically go looking for any other abnormalities other than we get scans on those patients typically every quarter or every 4 months, and we keep an eye on the scans and what's happening to the pulmonary parenchyma in those scans.
One of the issues that comes up, I'm not sure exactly how often it is, but you know, we talk about it in different disease states where checkpoint inhibitors are used, are patients with prior autoimmune diseases and sometimes patients who've had kidney transplants or other kinds of transplants. And usually this is in the metastatic setting, whether it's melanoma or whatever, you know, where you really don't have much choice. Whereas here, it's really kind of really adjuvant therapy. I don't know, have you had any patients with Crohn's disease or other autoimmune conditions? And if you did, how would you approach the decision about durvalumab in this setting?
Autoimmune disease as a background history for the patient is a concern when we consider starting them on immune checkpoint inhibitors. My initial approach is if they have active autoimmune disease that has required systemic therapy, I would not start those patients on PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor. Now, I've had occasional situations, I'm talking more in the metastatic, not as much in the stage 3 setting, where somebody said, I've had Crohn's disease 20 years ago, I've not had any activity over 20 years. I weigh the benefit versus risk, how bad is their lung disease, cancer, lung cancer, and whether I really need the PD-1 to help them. And in occasional situations, when I run out of options, I might re-challenge them with PD-1 inhibition. In the transplant setting, post-transplant setting, I certainly would not use a PD-1 inhibitor outside of a center where there's a lot of experience and teams to monitor autoimmune or rejection events very quickly and be able to monitor for that.
Where are we? You know, obviously, this trial is very encouraging in terms of the possibility of actual adjuvant therapy with checkpoint inhibitors. What are the trials that are out there? How are they designed? And when do you think we might see some answers?
So there are a lot of trials in the adjuvant post-surgical setting comparing immune checkpoint inhibition versus either placebo or observation. Some of these trials are nearing completion. At ECOG, we're doing a trial, part of the NCI Alchemist program, that compares nivolumab to observation after they have received chemotherapy. And that trial is very close to completing accrual. We're thinking in the next 4 to 6 months, we will be done with accrual. I think it'll still take another 2 or 3 years before we will start seeing results from these trials. There are similar trials with Pembro, Atezo, Durva that are all ongoing in various parts of the world.
Any predictions? And do you think there's any, I guess there's no way to know it, but I'm just kind of curious what your kind of speculations are, that some of the results, the positive results from the Pacific trial relate specifically to some interaction between radiation therapy, some synergy with checkpoint inhibitors. And of course, that's not the case in the adjuvant setting usually, but any thoughts about that?
The synergy with radiation clearly has something to do with why we're seeing a very robust survival results in the Pacific trial. In the adjuvant study, I'm very encouraged by what we've seen from some of the small neoadjuvant studies that have reported out with Nivo or Pembro or the Nivo-Ipi combination. Atezo has been given with chemo in one of the studies. Even though the results so far are from small cohorts, we're seeing major pathological responses. We're seeing clinical responses. The chemo plus Atezo study had a very impressive response rate. So to me, all of these tell us that even without the radiation piece, the checkpoint inhibitors may be active in that setting. And that's why I'm very upbeat on the adjuvant trials.
Really? I don't know. There's something about seeing a path CR with a checkpoint inhibitor. It's pretty cool. I saw this in bladder cancer, incidentally. Neoadjuvant therapy of path CRs.
That's practically unheard of.
Well, you can get it with chemo, I guess, but I don't know. There's just something really kind of amazing about that idea. And also, of course, the whole idea of neoadjuvant therapy as predictors, you know, breast cancer has that long history. So I guess we'll see that how that tracks out. Just want to get your pulse on first-line therapy metastatic disease in small cell. It sounds like things are coalescing together. When we do other tumor types, we always talk about the trials using chemo with checkpoint inhibitors in lung cancer, and really it's blazed the trail there, being looked at in a lot of situations. Where are we today right now? What's your first-line therapy for small cell cancer?
I think at this point, with the data from the atezo plus chemo trial showing very statistically significant median survival improvement, hazard ratio of approximately 0.7, I think that'll become the standard first-line treatment once it's FDA approved. The single-agent PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibition doesn't seem to do it in small cell lung cancer. We've seen that with atezo. We heard about the Nivo phase 3 trial, which did not show a survival benefit compared to topotecan. The ipi-nivo combination, we just heard from a press release that in the maintenance setting did not show superiority over placebo or over nivo alone. So I think at this point in small cell, the chemo plus atezo will be the first breakthrough that we will integrate into clinical practice.
So chemo being a taxane?
For small cell, it's etoposide platinum.
I'm sorry, etoposide platinum, right?
Platinum, okay, great. With atezolizumab.
I was thinking about squamous. So what about second-line therapy in patients who don't get checkpoint inhibitors first-line? For a while, I was hearing a lot of investigators talk about ipi-nivo in that situation.
That is approved by the NCCN guidelines in the second-line setting based on some single-arm, non-randomized trials. What we heard from the CheckMate 451 trial, which was a maintenance trial, nivo-ipi versus nivo versus observation in patients who had completed 4 cycles of chemotherapy showed no benefit for the nivo-ipi. So I think that brings about the need to reevaluate the role of nivo-ipi more comprehensively. Another trial, I will put it out there, that I'm eagerly looking for the results is with the drug called lurbinectedin, which has completed a phase 3 trial, and we are looking for results. What they had reported in a single-arm study was the combination of lurbinectedin and anthracycline resulted in a median PFS of approximately 1 year in the second-line setting. So that's very interesting, and we're looking forward to that.
What kind of drug is that?
Lurbinectedin is basically a toxin which inhibits DNA elongation.
So it's a cytotoxic agent?
It's like trabectedin, except that it basically, I believe, prevents nuclear elongation or DNA elongation as cells go through division.
What about so-called Rova-T in small cell? What is it and where is it?
Rova-T is an antibody drug conjugate. It targets this receptor called DLL3. And by using the antibody conjugate against DLL3, which is overexpressed in a good percentage of small cell lung cancer, the hope was to achieve tumor reduction. When we saw the first set of data with Rova-T, the response rate in tumors that were expressing DLL3 was close to 40%, which was highly encouraging. But more recently, as they have larger cohorts of patients, that response rate came down to about 20%. So the enthusiasm for Rova-T has taken a hit because of that. And more recently, we heard press release that one of the trials that compared Rova-T to topotecan was stopped by the DSMC, suggesting there was no evidence of benefit there. So I think the future of Rova-T is still up in the air. There are some toxicity issues with the drug, mainly in the form of skin toxicity and effusions, pleural peritoneal effusions that can cause problems for patients. So I would say Rova-T is very much still a drug under study.
So let me just clarify, though, in terms of where you are with checkpoint inhibitors in small cell, you said that chemo plus atezolizumab is your first-line therapy. In patients who don't get that first line, do you use checkpoint inhibitors?
At this point, the drug is not approved, Neil. So what I was going to clarify is when the drug is available, that would
right,
be my first
right.
line.
This is what you'd like to do.
I would like to do. Once patient progress on chemo alone and have not received a checkpoint inhibitor, I don't think single-agent checkpoint inhibition is going to be very helpful for those patients. We've seen very little responses, and the PFS data have been dismal. So that's not an approach that I would take.
What's your vision for the biology of small cell cancer, particularly as it relates to the immune system, but also in terms of genomic alterations?
That's the big question. We know that these patients have a number of mutations. We see MYC gene alterations. We see PIK3CA mutations. Schlafen-11 is another player in that space. Whether we can bring in targeted agents specific for those genomic abnormalities has been in question. We don't have a good mechanism right now to study it. There is no lung map equivalent in small cell lung cancer that will answer those specific questions. One example is Aurora kinase inhibition was being studied, And even though overall results were not positive, if you just look at patients with MYC gene alteration, there seemed to be benefit with Aurora kinase inhibition. PARP inhibition, again, with chemotherapy in the small cell setting, was related with the Schlafen-Levin status. So I think there is a need to study those combinations. With immunotherapy moving to the front line, we're going to be asking this question in the second line more and more, because once they progress on chemo plus PD-L1 inhibition, what do we do for those patients? Well, topotecan, but is there something better than that we can do?
What's the immunologic profile of small cell? You think about the smoker and a lot of genomic damage, but what's the tumor mutation burden and PD-L1 levels that you see?
So when we look at the tumor mutation burden graph, small cell has among the highest tumor mutation burden. However, PD-L1 expression seems to be lower in patients with small cell lung cancer or occurs at a lower frequency compared to non-small cell lung cancer. We clearly know that there are other players beyond PD-L1 and TMB, but there isn't any obvious marker that's out there beyond that at this point.
Interesting. Anything, any research that you're involved with, either laboratory or clinical research that you want to finish out, maybe mentioning?
Sure. Our program at Emory has focused on two or three key themes with regards to immunotherapy. One is need for co-stimulatory signal. We had published a paper in Science that CD28 activation was necessary for PD-1 inhibition to work effectively in preclinical models. So we're looking more and more at what is the CD28 status in a patient who is getting PD-1 inhibition and see whether that can be a biomarker. That's one area we're looking at. The second theme is our immunology group published a paper in Nature about the so-called stem-like CD8 T cells. These are the cells that proliferate after you expose a patient to PD-1 inhibition. And these stem-like CD8 T cells are not sitting in the tumor. They are sitting in the lymph nodes in specific areas. So can we look for these in surgical samples of patients in their lymph nodes where you would look for these stem-like CD8 T cells and use that to predict whether these patients will respond to PD-1 inhibition or not? Perhaps they need more than PD-1 inhibition, combination approaches. So understanding the biology of stem-like CD8 T cells is another key theme. The third theme I would mention is a paper we published looking at peripheral blood to look at proliferating fractions of T cells to see if that can help you identify early on whether patients are going to benefit or not. And we consistently have seen that patients who have a specific subset of CD8 positive, PD-1 positive T cells that express Ki-67, if they proliferate, which happens very early on within the first 3 or 4 weeks, those patients are the ones that benefit. If you don't see this proliferation in 3 or 4 weeks, those patients do not benefit. So we're trying to take these observations to the clinic to help us A, understand which patients are likely to respond to treatment, B, what additional signals and pathway modulations are needed in order to improve the efficacy of PD-1 inhibition in these patients.
Any interest in or work in the area of the microbiome and PD-1 inhibitors and antibiotics and PD-1 inhibitors?
Absolutely. There's a lot of excitement and interest in studying the interplay between microbiome and responsiveness to PD-1 inhibition. A number of groups are reporting on it. What specific bacterial flora you have may influence what side of a response you have. And the recent study noticed that if you give antibiotics, that had an effect on how patients responded to immune checkpoint inhibition. We are beginning to look into that. We don't have a lot of data to report out at this point, but certainly a very active area of interest.